Responsibility. Something goes wrong, they point fingers at one another. The perfect one-party system. And you all fall for it. Went down to Mexico City last week with my wife. A country whose only viable export is agriculture. A country with homeless. We were going to take our children. But my in-laws believed everything you've ever heard about Mexico City. Don't drink the water. Because of the peso has gone downhill. Man, it's really bad in Mexico and blah, blah, this. Went down to Mexico City. You almost are asphyxiated as soon as you get outside the airport, man, because that smog is thick. You can almost cut it with scissors. But it's a clean city. You don't see any homeless. And everyone is hustling, working on the streets. They're doing things. They're using their beat-up jalopies that they got down by their house or their tin shack. They're using that to be a taxi. They're doing everything they can to put money in their pockets and food on the table and shelter over their head. But they're working. They're on the streets, all over the streets, selling things. All over. Open market. That's what you call free market. And I was reading in the Mexican paper, newspaper, about how all the businessmen now are petitioning the government to stop these street vendors because they're taking away business. It's always perplexed me about capitalists, that you're a staunch capitalist until you own a business. Then you're against free market economics. You don't want competition, man. Now you want it all yourself. It's amazing. It's amazing, the contradiction there. I wanted to use Mexico City as an example of how this country tells you about the other places in the world, and you think that you're well off in a democracy. 42% of your income goes to government in taxes. In the history of the world, everyone, including the serfs of the feudal times, they rebelled and had revolutions when the tithe of their monarchies demanded up to 25%. When they had to give up 25% of their hard-earned income to a government, they rebelled. You guys are setting, or your folks, are setting history, a precedent. You're the first country that is allowing yourself to be robbed blind by your own government. 17% more than anybody else in history. Everybody else rebelled. Got rid of those governments that were oppressing them. I'm talking about the serfs, man. Welcome to the reservation. I mean, these are facts. Blame the Japanese. Point the finger. Point the finger at the Mexicans. Point the finger at the Japanese. Point it at the Taiwanese, at the Thais. Just start pointing fingers all over. Nobody's pointing a finger at Germany or at England, which owns more land than all the other countries combined in this country. People from England own more businesses in America than the Japanese. But nobody's pointing a finger at England. And you can get these facts in the worst newspaper in America. You just read it. It's in USA Today, in a little corner. Every once in a while, you get these facts, man. Welcome to the reservation. You're getting poorer and poorer. You know, the United States of America, economically speaking, is a banana republic now. It amazed me, Mexico City, a city of 21 million. 21 million. What's New York City have? 8 million? No homeless, man. And they're in a temperate climate. They never wear coats. Ever, man. But I go to New York City often in the wintertime, in the dead of winter. And it's homeless. In every neighborhood now, in every neighborhood. There used to be exclusive neighborhoods where they weren't, you know, just a few short years ago, but now the homeless are in every neighborhood. The East 50s, up on the West End, they're everywhere. Columbus Circle. And it's sad. This is also, statistically speaking, the most violent country in America. The most violent. A democracy? A democracy is the most violent? Per capita, the United States leads the world in the percentage of population in prisons. This is a democracy?
You've got a constitution, you've got a Bill of Rights. Then why do you have the IRS? Why do you have the FDA? Why the FCC? Or anybody or anything else in the alphabet? The BIA. You know? I call it the Bureau of Idiots Anonymous, probably more well known as the Bureau of Indian Affairs. There isn't any need for those bureaucracies. Not if you live in freedom. Not if you can, if you get laid off, you can turn your car into a taxi, or you can cook off your stove and sell your food out on the streets. You can't do that in this country unless you do it illegally, because you don't live in the proper zone. You don't have the proper license. You're not following the rules and regulations. You live in a democracy. You're supposed to vote and have representative government. Well, why then are you sitting there letting this country pass every year? Over 90% of the laws passed in these years are not repealable. In other words, you're living in almost totalitarian state. Over 90% of the laws passed every year in this country are unrepealable. That means the executive branch, with its rules and regulations and every one of its agencies, its bureaucracies, passing those rules, they have the force and effect of law. And if you don't believe that, then check the latest Supreme Court decisions in any year since the Rehnquist took over as Chief Justice, and even before that, where government is getting more and more precedence. Now you don't have the right to pray if it interferes with any agency of government. That's a fact. I know I was involved in that struggle along with every spiritual belief that is organized in this country, because they filed amicus briefs in our Supreme Court fight for religious freedom. That was about peyote, where two guys were fired because they belonged to the Native American church in Oregon. They wouldn't give them unemployment benefits to the LA Supreme Court. They ruled against us, even though every major, including Jewish faith, filed amicus briefs with the court. So Congress passes less than 10% of the laws in this country. Those are the laws that are repealable, provided you follow the processes that are necessary to petition your government for redress. Welcome to the reservation. I'm trying to buy some land. Right now I'm involved in trying to buy some land. My first time I'm trying to buy land in my life. Everywhere I go, you don't get water rights, you don't have mineral rights, you don't have any rights. And then I find out that for the rest of my life, I have to pay rent. And then my heirs have to pay rent on that land. And it's called property taxes. Who was the idiot in your history that allowed that to happen? I don't understand how anybody could allow themselves, their property, to be taxed, man. That means you don't own it. You or your parents own the property, man. You miss some payments on property tax, and the government owns it. This is Free market? This is democracy? That you pay rent to the government for eternity? And you don't have mineral rights? You don't have water rights? They can come in any time under eminent domain and take your property? I know because I was in Los Angeles a couple of years ago fighting with a mixed neighborhood of blacks, Asians, and Hispanics. And we marched and marched because a local school had condemned some homes to expand a parking lot based on eminent domain. Welcome to the reservation. Now understand the Six Nations. When the French in 1597 were in a military campaign against the Six Nations, and they had the Huron Confederacy, there was a French philosopher with that campaign, that military campaign. And he began to notice that among the Hurons and among the Iroquois Confederacy, they had this way of life that allowed for individual freedom and yet nationalism at the same time. And that people were truly free in these societies. So he asked the Hurons about it, and the Hurons, who were working with the French, were trying to explain it. He went back to France and wrote up about it, wrote it. Other French philosophers followed. More was written. The American Indian became heroes in Europe. Rousseau is the most famous, who wrote about the noble red man. And then, of course, that had to change because the American Revolution happened, the United States Constitution, the French Revolution happened. It was sweeping the world, this idea of individual liberty based on representative government. And the United States of America was founded, the Bill of Rights ensued, and in 1988, October of 1988, the United States Congress, both houses, unanimously passed a resolution thanking the Iroquois Confederacy for its major input into the development of the United States of America and its Constitution. So you see, this country doesn't have founding fathers who were not only racist, but sexist. In reality, you have founding mothers, and primitive ones at that. The clan mothers of the Six Nations Confederacy. The clan mothers of all the Indian people. They're the ones who choose the leader. They're the ones who can get divorces. They're the ones who have the strength, who prevent incest in anything, in any strata of society. They're the ones who are responsible. They're the true founders, the clan mothers of the Iroquois Confederacy, are the true founders of the United States of America. So you have founding mothers, not some idiot Eurocentric males, man, who wore powdered wigs, fluffy blouses, pedal pushers, silk stockings and high heels. That ain't my daddy. That ain't my daddy, man. Because when I was in the first grade, I was told that that guy on the dollar bill and up there on the wall of the school auditorium was the father of my country. I looked at that guy. That ain't my daddy. Just like Columbus, you know. In our society, we have what is called a contrary, a clown. It's to represent the other facet, the yang of the yin, or the yin of the yang, okay? To represent the other side, flip side of the same coin in life. And that's what Columbus was. He's a contrary. It shows you the ridiculousness of Eurocentric male chauvinism, okay? He traveled west to go east. He didn't know where he come from. Nobody knows. The Spanish have claimed him. The Portuguese have claimed him.
And he didn't tell anybody.
The only thing we know is that all he ever spoke was Spanish, and all he ever wrote in was Spanish. He died in disgrace. He's a visionary? Y'all are celebrating this clown?
Come on, man.
He's half a world off course. And believe me, you can't be more off course than a half of a world. The ultimate mistake. The ultimate navigational error. And you're letting your government spend $600 million of your money on this clown. Amazing. Welcome to the reservation. Sounds like the Bureau of Idiots Anonymous has permeated the United States of America. By the way, it was the BIA in 1824 that introduced sleaze into government. I kid you not, man. Research it. The first corruption in United States government history was discovered and exposed in the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And now, you know, if I was, I could not become a Republican because I was being afraid I might get elected or hired to work for the White House. I mean, every Republican administration, you get indicted, convicted, and sent to prison, man. I'd be scared to death if I was a Republican. And then those sleazos over on the Hill, man. The demo. I mean, a week doesn't go by and they're doing something perverted. You know? The Keating Five et al. Welcome to the reservation. Now, you know, one of the problems is the lack of recognition of the sacred colors. You know, Western civilization has appropriated many things from around the world and utilized it to the advantage of themselves. I find no fault in that. Good for them. However, had they done it with respect, I wouldn't be here tonight. And neither would you all. You'd be home with your families. You know, the American Indian people of the Western Hemisphere, we have contributed 60% of the world's foodstuffs. Over 70% of the medicines. We enabled Europe to enter into the Industrial Revolution through the mining of our gold and silver, and which allowed the common person in Europe to have means of monetary exchange for the first time in their history. Because prior to the exploitation and exploration of the Indian people in the Western Hemisphere, the only people who were being exploited and expropriated for gold and silver were the Africans, and they weren't producing enough there for money to reach all over Europe. So the only people who had gold and silver and monetary benefits in Europe, I could go on and on and on, but if you want to find out more, read Jack Weatherford's Indian Givers. There are many still. The most advanced features of architecture in the world are found in our cities. The modern day mining methodology developed from our techniques. On and on and on. No one's ever said thank you. We're the only color of the human race not allowed to participate in the family of nations, the red people of the Western Hemisphere. By the way, there was no country called India when Columbus wrote una gente indios, which translated means a people in with God. The English bastardized those two Spanish words, indio, indios, into Indian. All right? It was after we were being called Indians in the West Hemisphere that India and the East Indies became colonized. If you don't believe it, look on the maps of 1492. India was then called Hindustan. I just wanted to get that out real quickly here. But if there's an entire race of people not allowed to participate in the family of nations, Are we civilized? Are we indeed following our spiritual directions as practiced every Sunday in your churches or synagogues or temples? You know? I mean, think about it. The exclusion of an entire race of people. With that exclusion, then it's impossible. It's impossible to apologize, but more importantly, it's impossible to say thank you. Because if a people aren't included, who are you going to say thank you to? You know, if you live in a penthouse, are you going to say thank you to the farmer down in Georgia or Wyoming or Maine? Nobody says thank you anymore, huh? You have to have a society that can say thank you. It's simple. Life is not a complicated proposition. There's responsibility and there's irresponsibility. Irresponsibility allows for 42% of your income to be ripped off. Don't pay it. And see how fast you land in debtor's prison. How scared are you of your government? How much fear do you have? So much fear you can't say thank you to your neighbor, to a union, to a farmer, to a bricklayer, to everybody that contributes to your well-being, to my land, the Mother Earth. You can't say thank you to our grandmother, the Earth, which, by the way, Western science has now ascertained. In the early 80s, they drilled a hole in Greenland, of all places, for miles into the earth, and after studying it for the data coming up from that hole, for 2 years, they have ascertained that this is a living organism in space, not just an orb rotating around the sun. Respect your mother, and she will take care of you. That's a basic teaching in any responsible family. In any responsible family. Just think of a society that requires you cannot harm another human being. And it's feasible today. It's feasible today. That means the air you breathe has to be sacred. So if you have unlimited liability without government interference, then you can force the technology to be invented that will clean up the air, because they can't dirty it in the first place. They can't dirty the water. They cannot harm you. A society that cannot harm another individual. Now, if you want to harm yourself, that's a different proposition. But you got a constitution and a bill of rights that is on that path. You've already got the tools. So instead of fighting one another, you know, it just kills me, man. So you want to continue with the Demopublicans to the wharf? And the result? What's the result, man? Species suicide. Species suicide. Y'all thought it was going to be a holocaust of nuclear weaponry. You know? That's what you thought of just a few short years ago. In 84 and 85, under the Reagan Empire of Evil accusations, the school children, your age, man, were surveyed. And you were afraid of the nuclear holocaust. So you've got to understand, you got the tools, and you got the heritage from my people to be free. Then you don't have to fight one another. While the big boys put the money in their pocket, you know, get you to hate the Japanese and the Koreans et al., the Arabs. What's the campaign this year, you know? So I suggest you do something. Or what Chief Seattle said in 1854 is going to come true. And he said, continue to contaminate your bed, and one night you will suffocate in your own waste. He also said, tribe follows tribe, and nation follows nation.
It's like the waves of the sea. It's the order of nature. And regret is useless.
Your time of decay may be distant, but it will surely come. For even the white man's God who walked and talked with him as friend with friend could not escape our common destiny.
We may be brothers after all. We shall see. Thank you.
You were just listening to Russell Means, Welcome to the Reservation. This never-before-broadcast program was recorded at Bowdoin College in Maine in 1992. Russell Means was a renowned activist for indigenous rights. An Oglala Lakota, he was born on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. He was a founding member of the American Indian Movement, AIM, and its first national director. He passed away in 2012. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Noura Erekat, Winona LaDuc, Nick Estes, Arundhati Roy, and Chris Hedges. And we have a series of programs with Russell Means. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Russell Means, Welcome to the Reservation, and for Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's classic book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. MP3s and PDFs are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hello, this is Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Riona Duncan, and today I have Dean Shinas here to talk about freedom of speech on campus. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So free speech is a very broad topic you can probably talk about all day and all night. But specifically, I'm bringing you here because you've got a lot of expertise in dealing with it when it comes to college campuses. So what do you think makes the situation unique when it comes to this specific context?
Well, first, let me say this is not my topic. My expertise is a faculty member. But interestingly, I've had to become knowledgeable about it because of being a dean and all the things that have come up since I'm a dean for 10 years. So, you know, the big topic is that in order to actually do research and educate students and have people learn, there has to be a freedom of expression so people can test out ideas, they can say things that other people might find offensive, et cetera, et cetera. And so for us to actually function in the way we need to as a university, we have to maintain a healthy respect for and support for freedom of expression on campus.
OK, Can you start us off by giving us an example of a context where you've had to deal with threading that needle between being respectful, being a learning environment, and also letting people speak?
Sure. We've had a bunch of different really interesting events. But when I was early on in my deanship, one of my English professors came to me and said, can we do a year of events commemorating Karl Marx's 200th birthday? And I was like, sure. And we did that set of events, and then somebody did an article in the Trib that was critical of us covering Karl Marx and was picked up by some national media, and the trustees were unhappy, called our president, called our provost, called me, etc. And the president was very supportive in saying, look, this is academic freedom. We need to cover this. But it was extremely difficult to convince everybody that this is a crucial thing we have to maintain as a university if we're going to actually, even when they were very much against Marxism, the idea of Marxism, and took it to be a threat to the world in general.
So I feel like that also brings into play academic freedom, which is somewhat of a different thing than freedom of speech. How would you say the two interact?
Well, in freedom of speech, which is from our Constitution, this is a legal matter, and they've made lots of different decisions in the Supreme Court supporting it. And over time, it's become more and more clear that they're going to be extremely unrestrictive of freedom of speech. Hate speech is protected speech, weirdly enough, legally. And the reason is because you can't identify a set of words as hate speech without the context, making it really, really clear what's hate and what's not. And the example I'll give is all lives matter. Nobody would think those three words by themselves are really hateful speech. But in the context of when George Floyd was murdered and the fence was painted Black Lives Matter, and then someone came and crossed out black and put all lives matter became, I think, in many people's minds, an example of hate speech. And so I think that everybody in the legal system agrees that unless we can find a very, very clear definition of hate speech that we could apply in every context, then it's much, much better to not regulate it. On the academic side of the coin, in the academy, when research and education is the mission, there was, like many other institutions, no such thing as freedom of speech, because if you're in a company and you say something the company doesn't like, you can be fired even though the Constitution protects your right to say it. It doesn't protect you from saying it for that company. So the academy had to actually add protections so that when you were working in the academy as a professor or a student, you had protections that were at least more than you could actually ask in a company you worked for. And this all started in the very early 20th century when professors were routinely fired for their political views, their views that were critical of the campuses they worked on, etc. And the American Association for University Professors came up with not a union but an organization that tried to encode what do we mean by academic freedom and what does it actually allow us to do. And so from about 1915 until now, there's been a very, very powerful movement to try to make sure the academy protects freedom of speech and freedom of research and freedom of expression much, much more robustly than companies do, for example. Now, public universities are required to follow the constitutional protection, but private universities like Carnegie Mellon are not. We choose to.
So specifically, you were talking about Karl Marx, and that was Kathy Newman, who we have had on the show about banned books. But what would you say makes a university follow free speech? Because, I mean, Dr. Newman made the point that the Constitution is very vague. It's Congress shall make no law.
Right. Well, I would say the legal system and the way it's been the way the Constitution has been interpreted by the legal system is robustly protective of free speech. That's not to say that you can say anything you want. You can't make threats, right? You can't harass. You can't actually do child pornography. You can't do obscenity in public. There's many, many ways your speech is restricted. And in particular, time and manner. So if you want to say something politically, you can't go into someone's neighborhood and just shout it with a megaphone at 2 in the morning when people are expecting to be sleeping, right? So there's lots of ways in which there's restrictions. But I think in the academy, when we're trying to have an environment in which people can explore potentially controversial ideas, transgender rights, abortion, the Israel-Palestinian conflict, etc., etc., we need an environment in which people can explore different perspectives, different opinions, different, you know, ways of thinking about this thing freely so they can hear counterarguments and so they can learn. And so the other topic I wanted to make sure I get to is the difference between the kind of restrictions or non-restrictions we get from the law and from policies on campus and the kind of restrictions on speech from social norms, right? So many students will tell me that, you know, if they're on social media or they're in a group of friends, there's things they don't say because they're afraid of being shamed or they're afraid that what they'll say is looking at weird, it's not the in-group's opinion, et cetera, et cetera. So in my view, that's a much more powerful influence on restricting and chilling your speech than any policy I as a dean will put forth or we as a university will put forth. Would you agree?
I think it depends because there's definitely ways that universities can fully shut down speech. But also, I do agree that social norms are a very powerful motivator.
I mean, we found just by looking at some data, asking some surveys and questions, that the students feel very uncomfortable sharing controversial opinions, especially if they're conservative opinions, with their peers on campus, not just in class. And so I think for sure there's a pretty large social pressure that many students feel.
Yeah. So I feel like that also doesn't just apply to students, because I know professors and academics also have a bit of an issue with viewpoint diversity.
Absolutely. So if you're a professor in a class, right, there's so many ways you can step on a landmine and do something that's stupid, right? And in many of these situations, you're not trained, right? You're trained in your subject. You're not trained on how to manage a class so that there's an appropriately respectful environment for a wide array of viewpoints. Nor are you trained to figure out how to run a class so that if there's a very small representation of a certain minority, you don't treat them, right, in a disrespectful or harmful way. You know, I've seen at least a dozen incidents where professors were not just accused, but, you know, put into a situation where something they did in class was questioned. And then their reaction to it was to say, I'm not going to do any of this ever again. I'm just going to talk about my subject down the road and then leave. You know, so that's a really unfortunate chilling of what professors need to do as well.
Yeah. And also, I think a thing about professors is that most of them, by far, are more on the liberal spectrum. So that's also a thing where you only get one perspective.
Absolutely. I mean, we know that. And it's very, very difficult for professors to understand where the line is between challenging something they think is factually inaccurate, that a person on the other side of the spectrum might say, or something that they just take to be sort of a misguided political perspective. And I think that I should also mention that academic freedom, as it's been understood, right, does not give professors, right, carte blanche to just weigh in on subjects that they don't really know. So if you're a physics professor and you just stop class in the middle of talking about neutrinos and say, I want to rant against Kamala Harris or rant against Donald Trump, that is not protected by academic freedom.
No. Well, if it's not your area of expertise, it's kind of a captive audience issue.
Yeah, I think that's true. And you have to be respectful of the fact that, you know, you might feel passionately about a subject and you might believe that you're opening the class up to discuss it in a very equal way. But there's a clear power imbalance and the students have to know or have to at least feel that they're at risk of if they say something that you find politically very, very untasteful, that their grade might be at risk as well. And I can't blame the students for feeling that. That makes perfect sense to me.
With, you know, the issue of students feeling afraid to challenge their professors or afraid to challenge the social norms of their friend groups. Does CMU have any initiatives to try and counteract that?
Yes, we have several, and you were a part of one. So in the Dietrich College, we have a seminar program for first-year students called the Grand Challenge Seminar Program. We take topics that are challenging to the world, racism, climate change, food security, academic and freedom of expression. And we try to cover them from a multitude of disciplines. In the course of the Grand Challenge Seminar on Academic Freedom that I taught and you were a student in, which was a great experience for me, we spent a lot of time in the beginning trying to get the environment of the class to be bought into the idea of respect. So we were very, very passionate about telling everybody that no matter what people say, no matter how offensive it might seem to you, we must be respectful and welcoming of all viewpoints, all perspectives. And it took a few weeks, but the students, I think, were incredibly good about buying into that and actually exhibiting that behavior. And then when October 7th happened and the attack on Israel from Hamas happened, we turned the syllabus around and we said, let's discuss this. Defense was posting messages that were very, very provocative and offensive to one group or the other. And then in the class, I think the students took what we had tried to set up and really used it and were incredibly civil and very constructive. And I think we learned a lot. I mean, I learned a lot about the intent, right, of Palestinian Alliance students when the messages came out that Jewish students might find offensive and what the Jewish students were hearing and vice versa. And so it felt like real learning was taking place in a classroom. So I think initiatives, what we want to do is make sure that as faculty, we can teach classes in which we do the kind of civil discourse. We model it, we teach it, we encourage it, and we can see progress happen when students actually get something big out of that. And as administrators, we can try to create events and try to create other things that go on the campus, like the Deeper Conversations series we had, in which we're willing to take on these controversial issues as opposed to just being silent about them. We're willing to have discussions, and the conditions are that the discussions have to be civil. I feel like this is an issue we've just started to take on, but this is like one of the big issues that the academy or the institutions of higher education in the U.S., they need to lean into. If we can't take this on and get faculty and students to have civil discussions, no matter how polarized they might start, who's going to do it?
I feel like freedom of speech is especially a big thing on CMU's campus right now because there are new restrictions in terms of assembly and protest. So a lot of students have been protesting that and kind of are really upset about it. What's your perspective on that?
Yeah, that's unfortunate because I mean, I know from my side of the fence on the administration that was not the intent at all. So what's basically happened is when protests happen or when student expression on campus happens, with or without outside people, the university feels very responsible to make sure that's safe. And what we have experienced from last year is that some of the events get very passionate and some of the people who are coming in from the outside or even coming in from the students are passionate enough that where they're trying to provoke something that I wouldn't say is just violence, but provoke something that will break out into potential violence. The campus police tell us that if they have notice there's going to be some event, right, that's going to be sizable, then they're going to be much, much more able to protect the safety of the people involved in that event from people who came and were on counter-protest to whomever. And so the idea of the policy for 25 people to register was simply to give us a better ability to keep these events safe. And that we have a complete commitment to the content of the protest has nothing to do with it. So if you're a group that's liberal and you register versus you're a group that's conservative to register, we don't care. The only thing motivating that is so we are better able to provide the security that we need to keep these things physically safe.
So as a reminder, this is Forbes Avenue. I'm Riota Duncan talking with Dean Shinas about free speech. So on that topic of the administration's view, you were part of the Commission on Academic Freedom and Free Speech. Can you tell me a little what it's like about being in that kind of room?
Yeah, that was fascinating. So the commission learned an awful lot about, what are best practices, what's the history of this thing. We got some great speakers to come in, Keith Whittington from Princeton, Erwin Chersminsky from Berkeley, other people too. And what I think we learned was that even though it's in many cases desirable to prevent people from doing events, having speech that is potentially offensive or hateful, that anything you might do to try to restrict that is probably worse in the long run than supporting the freedom of the students to hear all different kinds of perspectives, even if some people find some of them very offensive. Now, I say that, but in the room, in that committee, there were very clearly two sort of groups that evolved, and one group I would describe as more concerned with protecting, right, the environment from hateful, right, hateful speech or hateful groups or things like that. And another of the group, or the other side of the group, was more on my side, which is more supportive of free speech. I think both of us are passionately committed to the fact that we do not want a culture that's hateful or having things like that happen. But I think the approach that distinguishes us is, on my side of the fence, instead of doing it legally and with policies, let's try to do it culturally. Let's try to get the students, right, and the faculty and the staff if there's someone coming in who's hateful, to push back on them. And so we need to protect the speech of the people pushing back on the haters as much as we need to protect the speech of the people who are potentially hateful. But on the other side of the fence, I think there are people who say that's not going to be good enough. There's still going to be people who are coming in and being anti-Semitic or, you know, very hostile to abortion rights or transgender rights or other things that are controversial. And that letting those people come to campus and speak, right, is creating an environment that's simply unsafe or unconducive to learning. So it was a tricky issue to try to figure out where we actually came down on, and so I think in the end we agreed that we'll modify our policy a touch, but that we were going to be robustly protective of freedom of expression in general. In the long run, we think that's a better strategy.
I forget who said this, but someone said that the best response to hate speech is more speech.
I agree with that. I mean, here's the thing: you might think that I'm an okay person, and I'm okay, well, maybe not, but you might think I'm okay. So if I have to make a judgment on whether something's hate speech, you might trust me to do that reasonably. But we know from history that if the deans and the provost and the president have the ability to shut down speech because they deem it hateful, then someone down the line is going to abuse that power. And then the people end up suffering the most from that ability of administrators to shut down speech are the people who need it the most. And so to sacrifice that people or those people in the future, right, in the present, giving us more power to sort of push back against what might be considered offensive and hateful, not to everybody, but to some, seems to me a bad trade-off. And I think that we have to be willing to be uncomfortable in many contexts in order to protect it so that down the road, some administrator who's not well-intentioned is not able to shut down students who have a really good point to make or shut down protesters who have a good point to make. We have to hear it.
I was wondering what you thought of accountability mechanisms for free speech on campus or academic freedom, because for private universities like us, it's not that we're bound by Congress.
And I think we have to be clear in our policies to make that a value that we're actually putting out there as core value of the institution. So I think we did a great job on the Karl Marx thing. I think we did a great job on the Rick Grinnell, Ambassador Grinnell, coming to campus. It was huge controversy over that. Many, many people wanted us to disallow it or fire him. We didn't. And I think there was a similar thing over Uju Anya and her critique of the Queen, right, which was also, I think, highly controversial. But we stood up and we protected her ability to say that and Rick Grinnell's ability to say that and et cetera, et cetera. So I think the policy has to be clear, and we have to actually walk the walk, not just talk the talk. We have to make it visible to people the positive side of it, right? And we have to make sure that people can have experiences in classes or in deeper conversations or in other places where they come out of it, right? They come through being offended. They come through being uncomfortable and learn something. So I just think we have to find ways to make it vivid and visible to our students and to our faculty that even though it might be uncomfortable, the positives are great.
So in terms of making it visible, how would you say Carnegie Mellon's been trying to do that?
Well, the two examples I gave, I'll go back to. One is the classes, and there's another class I'll point to called Dangerous Ideas, right, which Simon Cullen put forth, which explicitly took on the idea of very, very controversial topics and tried to get people to talk about them in productive ways, factually and otherwise. Danny Oppenheimer teaches a class called Human Stupidity and Human Intelligence, Thinking Online versus Thinking in Person. And in both cases, he takes on very controversial issues and tries to get the students to learn how to debate these issues, right, in ways that in the end will be much more helpful to them than just shutting each other down. And then the president and the deans, especially the dean of Hines and the dean of Dietrich, me, have made a pretty big commitment to these deeper conversations where we try to get the issues that are controversial of the day, the Israel-Hamas, Israel-Palestinian conflict, and now the election, the polarization that's a part of it, and lean in, get it out there, and try to create venues and events and forums in which people really can discuss these things and hear perspectives that are sufficiently diverse that they can learn. And I think in the deeper conversations last year, we were very nervous about it, but we had these discussion groups on this book called Contested Histories. We had about 10 people run discussion groups, and students, faculty, and staff were all invited to come in, and each one of them filled up. And by all reports, most of those conversations went very well. There were a couple of difficult issues that came up, as one would expect. But I think what came out of it was that we need to keep doing these things. So we're not afraid to talk about controversial topics. We invite the students to come talk about it. We get readings that actually matter. We get people to come lecture who are serious, who are not just provocateurs, right? These are all hard issues, or they wouldn't be controversial. So, I mean, I just think that we have not only a duty, but we've also seen that if we do it and we do it well, it works. And that's, to me, very exciting.
In terms of discussing controversial issues, what do you think about universities who put out, you know, statements about the hot topics of the day?
I mean, as a dean, I have been in several situations where, you know, people were pressing me and pressing the university to come out and say something in support of or in defense of or condemning. There's often a very, very strong number of people who can say, you need to condemn, right? And you're very conscious as a dean or a provost or a president that no matter what you say, you're going to, you know, make somebody angry. You know that, right? And you know also that you can't be just expressing what you believe because you're not speaking for yourself. You're speaking for the institution. And so that's inherently an impossible task and ridiculously complicated. And I think that more times than not, we get it wrong or we do more damage than we might have done by just staying silent. So I kind of believe that the default should be silence. We should not expect administrators, right, to take positions on social issues because that's not their job. Their job is to create an environment in which those issues can be explored, discussed, learned about, researched. But, right, not every issue can be, we can't be silent about every issue. And the example that everybody keeps coming back to argue against that with is, suppose you were an administrator in 1932, 1933 Germany, and the Nazis were taking over. I mean, you would not want to look back and say, I said, no, don't say anything. And the same thing, I think, about George Floyd. I mean, I think that was such a crystallizing moment in the struggles we've had with racism, you know, in our society, that for people to say nothing would have been inappropriate in a certain way. And yet, when we did come out with a statement, we got savaged from both sides, right? Some people say that statement's much too weak, and then some people said that's much too strong. So, you know, one tries to make it split down the middle to some extent. But I really feel like the amount of hours that administrators have taken over trying to get a message that they really think represents the institution appropriately, what its values are, and that addresses its constituencies in a way that they'll be able to hear as opposed to find offensive or objectionable, you would be stunned at. I'll just say that. And I don't really think that you want me, right, and the other administrators on campus spending a lot of our time and our emotional energy worrying about those kind of messages ad nauseum. I think you'd rather me spend my time worrying about, like, what kind of a great program can we put together, right, that brings together statistics in English, you know, for something like that. So neither extreme works. You can't weigh in on everything, and you can't weigh in on nothing. But I would much rather see the default be that nobody expects us to weigh in. Much, much cleaner that way.
So you were mentioning social media. How do you think that contributes to the whole situation on campus and in the world?
Let me go out on a limb here and say I deeply hate social media. I mean, I think so. We have had so many incidents where somebody had some reaction to something that got posted on social media. It blew up or ricocheted around and people, you know, got very upset about it before I even knew about it. You know, so it's the cycle of the social media explosion. It's not a week. It's not even a day. It's just an hour. And so, you know, you can't find the people that need to address it and answer it within an hour or within 2 hours every time. It's not practical. And there's been so many times where somebody has taken something and then gone with it on social media that in retrospect turns out to be not just false, but radically false or misleadingly false, right? And so you're in this trap where the speed of it and the way it amplifies and reaches so many people is so overwhelming and so much beyond our own capabilities, right? Even if I go onto social media and try to actually stop the bleeding or say something, right? You know, inevitably, the speed with which I have to do it, I'll make some mistake and say something that somebody finds ridiculously, or and then that will be its own story. And so every time we've been in these situations, And we consider, well, we need to respond to that. They're saying something we know to be false. Somebody else says, don't see anything. You'll just make it worse. You'll provide gas to the fire. And they're right. So as quickly as it blows up, it tends to die down. But I think in general, the social media that I've seen, it worsens the discourse in almost every way.
Social media is great at letting people speak, but it's not so great when it comes to amplifying, say, misinformation or dangerous lies or even just things out of context.
Correct. And it's also not so great at somehow creating an environment in which people feel entitled or safe to say truly horrible things, troll people, and use statements that they would never say face-to-face because they're just too offensive and they're too socially unacceptable. But in social media, there's no problem to say it. And I think that, so I think it brings out the worst in us in a certain way. And I think it's just for all the political issues of the day, made everybody's life more stressful, more anxious, and worse. Is that extreme enough, Abby?
Well, I think a lot of people have a complicated relationship with social media.
Oh, yes. And I know I'm extreme, but I'm old. I'm in a generation where, you know, we didn't do social media, right? You know, and I brought up three daughters, and I remember this vividly with this age where when they were like interacting with their friends, sometimes they'd speak in person, sometimes they'd call them on the phone, sometimes they'd text them, and they would modulate what they did depending on how intense the interaction was maybe going to be, right? We never thought that. And so, you know, so I think the social media is just another outgrowth of that. It's a way to actually modulate how you're going to say something, but the way it gets amplified is just very unfortunate.
So if social media is part of the problem, what would you say is the solution to finding a good balance on this very thorny issue?
Well, I don't think you're going to stop social media. It's going to be what it is, and people are going to use it. And hopefully, over time, people will come to feel about social media that it's just sort of it's toxic, like, you know, like Twinkies are toxic, right? It's such a nice sugar high quickly, but if you keep eating Twinkies every day as your whole diet, you're going to feel like crap. Right. And I think the same thing is true of social media. I think if that's your main diet and you get addicted to it, it's just stressful. You feel anxious. You don't feel good. So I think hopefully if we provide better and more opportunities for people to interact in person and have discussions that they actually can enjoy, et cetera, and learn from, that they'll choose to do more of that and less of the social media. That's pretty optimistic and hopeful, but I'll stick with it.
Well, is there anything else you want to say before we run out of time?
I think that when I have had the experience of getting students and getting faculty into contexts in which they have enough time and they have enough safety to say what they actually think and to explore it, they behave well and they behave incredibly intelligently and they end up doing things and saying things that we all learn from. So I believe that I've already seen enough evidence to show that if we can create the context in which speech right, can be free and productive, that is going to be a positive thing as opposed to a negative thing. So I'm encouraged, but I think it's going to take us an enormous amount of work to get there.
This has been Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I've been Riona Duncan, and my guest today has been Dean Shinas. Thank you.
Thank you.